Coming from the lower eight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. Welcome once again to the Are You Serious Show. This is an exciting show. We're going to be talking to Larry Harvey. Once again, and you know, we were just up at a party down the street having some free mumia and beer, and we were talking about which one of the Bush girls that we thought would be the first to appear in one of those homemade porn films that keep on coming out, and I think we all kind of agree it'll probably be Jenna, but...
She's the blonde one?
Yeah, I think, is Jenna the blonde? Jenna's the brunette.
Blonde.
No, Jenna's... I don't know, she's the cute one, but
maybe she's not
who knows
that.
Now we know that we've identified one as the cute one.
Then okay. Anyway, I'd like to hear from you and see what you think about it. Anyway, we are here today with Jeff Deal and with Diana Brown. Welcome, Diana.
Welcome. Come right in. You can't afford to miss this. Step right up.
Today's the first day of the rest of your life, baby. Or the last day. Whoa.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
I think we've discovered that you are going to be contacting Osama to become your literary agent. Is that correct? Are you?
I know everybody's trying to send their books to Osama.
Unsolicited manuscripts.
He's going to be swamped.
He won't be able to do anything else.
We can only.
Well, I mean, I think we're all referring to his recent speech in To America, in which he makes his recommendation of the first on his new book club, and he recommends we all read Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower by William Bloom. Now, this is not to be confused with Rogue States, The Rule of Force in World Affairs by Noam Chomsky.
I wonder if Chomsky is getting a little boost off of this, too, because I mean, when I went to Google and typed in Rogue State, number one came up was Chomsky.
See, I think he's beating this guy out, which is a good thing for
and
both
Chomsky
of them.
Probably has more copies of his book available. I saw this guy on TV, and he said there were only 2,000 copies printed. He's unprepared to take advantage of this
windfall
massive
of fame.
How does that work anyway? If Amazon numbers aren't based on sales, what else is it based on? Review?
Yeah, that's a whole
interesting
question.
That's a really good question.
Are the number of people who look at it?
I don't know, because I looked it up and it said that right now William Blum's book, Rogue State, is currently at number 35, just ahead of Harry Potter and just behind Strunk and White. So I'm not
but
really
there have
sure
only been
criteria.
2,000 copies ever printed. So.
Exactly. I'm
and
not
if
really
you
sure
go there today, it says it's not available.
Exactly.
Check back later. But I was thinking, you know, when I heard that Bin Laden had recommended a book without having heard anything else about it, I thought it would have been real cool if he had just sort of recommended some light summer reading.
Like, I know.
You know, in the middle of this great political religious rant, you say, by the way, check out Danielle Steele's latest book. It's great summer reading.
A new bodice ripper.
Or read American Psycho. I think it's, you know, it's twisted, but it's brilliant. And then back to, you know...
Back to jihad.
Let's talk about the infidels.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, and what I liked, though, was Blum went on to say that the quote is actually from one of his later works, Freeing the World to Death. But an actual quote from Rogue State is, Washington's war on terrorism is as doomed to failure as its war on drugs had been. Now, you mentioned you can't get the book right now on Amazon. I wondered about that. They do recommend that one check back frequently in case the book becomes available, which caused a few of my more suspicious friends to wonder, so are they keeping track of who's coming back wanting the book? And will there come a time in this country when reading this book is actually an act of terrorism?
Well, I mean, given you know, all the information about NSA spying and so forth,
exactly.
I would say that going off and trying to get this book would be a good way of getting your name on a list. But I
and
think
hey, you can't really argue against the government getting that information. I mean, after all, if you're reading a book by someone who sympathizes with bin Laden's cause, then the government needs to know that.
You might read this book and want to fly into a building. But maybe without an airplane.
Well, you know what I like is that...
Start flapping your hands. You know. Who knows? Who knows what's in this book?
Well, you know, bin Laden's number two does not want to be left out of this media hoopla. So you know, he did release his audio tape of poetry. Apparently, you said he's read this poem many times.
I think we do have a daytime variety TV show coming together here between bin Laden's latest statement and his number
two. Exactly. And, you know, jihadist web users have given it an 8, saying it has a good beat. And you can dance to it.
We're here with Larry Harvey, Burning Man, main man, leader, whatever you would call it. We've spoken to him before, and I'm not going to go through a long introduction. So welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. there's like a feedback loop between you doing Burning Man, like this first Burning Man, and then other people coming in and doing other stuff related to it, and it evolved into its own kind of organism. What are some of the things that people have done for Burning Man, artworks or whatever, that has really amazed you or astonished you over the years?
A particular artworks?
Yeah, or anything that people has done that you just gave you pause and made you go, wow.
Well, a lot of things have given me pause.
Pick out one or two.
I'll pick out one artwork because it's going. It will be erected in front of City Hall on November 17th in San Francisco. A 45-foot sculpture. At its top, it looks like the torso of a quadruped. But it's four limbs then divide into 8 and 16 until it becomes this dendritic structure that roots itself in the ground. 45 feet tall, a lot of metal, beautiful and grotesque, compelling, delicate. At the same time, its neck turns as if its attention were suddenly attracted, but the neck just ends in nothingness. There is no head. An enigmatic object, and we're our foundation is going to install it at the Civic Center Plaza. That's one of the things that's happening. We're bringing the art of Burning Man back into the world, and we're starting with San Francisco. Just to set an example, we have some plans. There are things brewing for Detroit. To make a temple, David Best is doing this, a temple out of discarded auto parts.
Yes,
you'd be surprised
that.
How cheap real estate is in Detroit.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And how many, and discarded auto parts, it's a super abundant resource.
Plenty of that there, yes.
And
great statement.
And that's a statement that has some political implications. So that's another example. David also plans to do something at Hunter's Point. Which I think would be very interesting. If anyone can do this, and that's a huge challenge, believe me, not because it's Hunter's Point, but because of the general environment. There's not only Hunter's Point, there's West Point. It's like the Capulets and they're sworn enemies. And to do anything in one of those communities, you're going to have to unite the two. It's a huge challenge. And so that's art and politics again intermingling.
It's be interesting to follow.
In some ways that's what you're doing with Burning Man. I mean, if Burning Man is your art form, then you're mounting this, I mean, it's like mounting a campaign or something like that. It's not just producing a product. It involves lots of human interaction and people doing stuff.
A lot. That's why for years I persisted in making it. We fund some of the art, not even the majority really, but probably the majority of the large things. And one of our criteria, not hard and fast, but one that we pressed, we've rewarded people for is to make their art interactive, to oblige people to act in relation to it and one another.
Right.
And so that's art that convenes society around itself. It's a sort of an antidote for the passivity and alienation that comes with living off your credit card in a consumer society.
Have you been surprised by the response to Burning Man? I mean, going back to like 1986, was there a point where you go, "Whoa, this is getting out of control"?
I'm not really surprised by it. I mean, in an ironic way, you can parallel the development of Burning Man with the development of evangelical Christian movement.
Right.
And I'm going out on a limb on saying this, but
I'm making a formal comparison.
Right. Has anyone wondered why people flock to those churches? Well, it's because they're looking for transcendence in a world that seems to have none.
Right.
Well, over on this, if we must make these distinctions, the red and the blue is ridiculous, but if we must make these distinctions, and they're hallowed, red, right, and left, go back centuries. Over on the side of the left, there was a whole period when transcendence became anathema. It was transcendence. You mean hegemony? You mean patriarchy? You mean oppression? I was yelling. I got so excited.
It still is anathema to a lot of rationalists.
The only trouble is in a world dominated by consumerism, people pant for transcendence.
Right.
And whoever offers it to them, even if it's a fraud. Even if it turns out that God and Mammon are frolicking in bed at the top, on the suite, the penthouse, the flock is being controlled in highly manipulative ways. Nonetheless, the impulse that has drawn, the heartfelt impulse that draws people to that, isn't some attraction to ideology, really. I don't think the average evangelical Christian cares about the tripart nature of God. They want to go to a place where there's something at the center that's larger than them.
Than themselves. Right.
Than themselves. And through communion with it, they feel that it touches their innermost part, their soul, and that through that experience, they are united with those gathered around that transcendence together in a society. That's what they want. Whenever religious people with pamphlets come to my door, I just talk to them in those terms.
They get confused?
They get confused enough. They go away, but well, they might end up at Burning Man. But the left would do well to look at many of the things the right did. No, I don't believe in top. I'm not a big fan of top-down systems. I'm not even a great fan personally of monotheism, but since it has this imperial cast, but I'm a great fan of transcendence. I always have been. Since 1986, when we were impressed by a figure 2 feet taller than us, on fire.
In our first conversation. I start off mentioning pagan rituals, which you kind of pushed away. But isn't that what the pagan rituals
brought
people? Well,
it's just
people?
Supernatural.
And it's like the gathering around.
Drawn to a religious iconography and many things associated with religion. Certainly, those things that evoke the sacred feeling. However, I have this condition, which I've never had treated. The supernatural makes me break out in hives. It stuffs up my nose. I can't breathe. I start shaking.
That means you're possessed.
it might. Perhaps that's the very evidence of it. But I've never thought that was necessary to spiritual experience. Ever, and certainly not. I hear people say, "Oh, I've never had a spiritual experience." What nonsense! I've heard people say, "I don't believe in the sacred." Well, talk to them for a little while and find out, what they're really protective of. You can tell it. You can find out what it is. It doesn't take long, 10 minutes, and then cross that boundary and see what's sacred. Mm-hmm. And they'll let you know that you have questioned something that they feel has an unconditional value, and you will not desecrate it.
Well, what's sacred is their disbelief in the sacred.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I know. That can't
talk
be done.
To a hardcore rationalist.
Sacred cow by any other name.
I'm a person who doesn't think belief should be unconditional. But I think certain kinds of experience should and can be and hopefully often is. I'm someone who thinks children should be given unconditional love. Doesn't mean they should be able to get away with everything,
right.
But it does mean that they should be loved unconditionally, not because they're trying to please you.
And, well, let's
and so certain things, isn't that what we all want most in life? Is that's my theory, at least, that people want to just be unconditionally what they are.
Right.
That's what they want.
Permission.
And much of the evil in this world comes from thwarting that need.
Well, let's break for a moment for some music, and we'll ask Larry, since he brought up kids, we'll ask him about his personal life.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
We're back with Larry Harvey, and I wanted to ask Larry if Burning Man is carried into his personal life and how it is, and if he sort of lives in a house with lots of burning people. And in fact, you mentioned kids. Are there any kids in the Larry Harvey genetic pool and that sort of thing?
I have a son who's 22. I have a nephew who's older than that.
Do they go to Burns?
Yes, both have.
All right, cool.
I do not live in a house full of Burning Man people.
No.
And I don't want to.
Neither do I.
but I live in an apartment building.
All right.
Two blocks from here. But
you travel around a lot, though.
I do travel around quite a lot, yeah.
And does your life basically sort of revolve around the Burning Man thing? Or when you're traveling around, you're meeting people who are involved in some way?
Well, yeah, and that can be a good thing and a bad thing. The good thing is by the time people get to me, they've been filtered through our culture, and I meet just wonderful people all the time. And I've been around the world long enough to know that's not a typical sampling.
Right.
You know, it's usually a little more varied. You know, I just keep meeting just people are as good as gold. I mean, wonderful folks, and so that's a blessing. It's a personal blessing for me. And when you're fundraising, it's a very useful thing too, especially if they want to give and help. And I'm doing more of that for our foundation, because that's what foundations are for—to raise money for good works. The bad thing is, of course, that that you can end up feeling like Jerry Lewis is Jerry Langford in the King of Comedy, and people will look at you as if they wanted to wrap you in cellophane and take you home, put you in the microwave. Right. And that's very isolating. But then you come to terms with that and try not to take it personally. And lately, well, I've been doing something very important. I'm completely throughout everything, and I'm redecorating my apartment. So I will actually have a home, because I got derailed for a few years and just lived outwardly, and I'd just come home. It'd be where I'd slouch in front of my computer.
Right.
And now I'm doing this very meditated redecoration in a way that as you design a garden so that I can have enough stamina to do what I want to do in the world. And I've got a lot of work ahead of me.
So you described kind of how the Burning Man project has extended itself into a lot of other areas of your life. What about these rumors that I hear every once in a while about, you know, establishing a permanent city and so forth? What are your thoughts on that?
A permanent city in the Black Rock Desert?
Somewhere, based on Burning Man. Yeah, I have heard on that.
Well, you know,
area,
I don't really like utopias very much. There's something so boring about them. I just finished a utopian novel, as a matter of fact. Something so frightfully smug. Something that doesn't allow for the innate pluralism of reality. Mm-hmm. You know, unless interested in a permanent community, then affecting the larger world on a greater scale, and that could create. We were talking about the diaspora of hippie communes. You know, it could generate something like that.
Which didn't work that well, generally.
No, they didn't. As a matter of fact, they found a study was done. What fascinated me, the two kinds survive for any length of time. One were those held together by charismatic personalities, but of course that's unstable. And the other was the original of them all, Drop City, where people came and left pretty quick and dropped money.
Right.
And that kept it going for some while. Drop City lasted for quite a while. And everything in between, well, you know, somebody would, you know, too many people would fuck each other am I allowed to say that on?
Absolutely.
How
come everybody asks? Well, never mind.
You know,
we should tell people before they come on.
Got a big list of you can say all these words.
The seven words you can say.
If people would just get, you know, sick and tired of one another, is what would happen. And they didn't go anywhere. I'm more interested. You see, the people who come to Burning Man come from incredibly varied backgrounds. I mean, amazing people. Republicans come to our event.
Sure,
they do. That's
and that's fine. I don't hate Republicans. I may marvel at some of their leaders, but I don't hate Republicans. So we have this enormous, deep reach into the worldly world. And that is just fascinating. We began to discover that when we had to fight for our life politically. And it turns out or when we had to go after corporate entities that were trying to commodify our name. And in every case, there's always somebody in their office who comes to the event.
Right. I mean, that's one of the big distinctions, say, between Burning Man and something like the Rainbow Festival, or like, you know, these sort of really marginalized hippies.
They took another turn. They made another decision.
Right.
Then if you're talking about applying the ethos that has been generated by the immediate experience of Burning Man, that suggests that you could apply it in a rather revolutionary way. That suggests that you could reach in to boardrooms. Mm-hmm. You could reach in to political establishment. You could reach into a lot of places and use worldly tools, but use them in light of a vision born of the desert.
Well, I guess that brings to light the last question in terms of reaching in. There is also the thing of reaching in and then being sort of the joke in a television show or something like that. Burning Man has been, you know.
Oh, that's harmless.
Stuff like that.
Do you realize that those I think we've been on this jokes on The Simpsons and the. It just goes on and on, right? They just did Malcolm in the Middle.
Right, Malcolm in the Middle. That's
but if you look at those shows, the joke made is often the tenderest of jokes. They write Valentines, and I can.
I would expect the Simpsons.
It's because the writers, the creative class,
of course,
the creative class in Hollywood, and this includes directors and producers, come to our event.
Right.
These are love tributes.
Yeah, well, the publisher of Time magazine took all his people to Burning Man one year.
He took one, actually. He was going to a wedding. He was hijacked by his Joel Stein. It was Walter, his writer.
Walter Isaacson,
who I became friends with.
Yeah, I know Walter.
And he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
I like him.
Yeah.
I've meant to get in touch with him for some while and haven't got around to it. So I don't see that as there's nothing sinister in that. In fact, we want to go to these people and ask them to help us help our nonprofit now next.
It has large
designs in the world.
It's an interesting distinction in terms of how a lot of people see alternative culture and this sort of interchange.
People get
that there are desires out there among people who might be considered the elite to view the world in different ways and participate in the world in different ways than people who don't have these sorts of connections would suspect.
Well, it's funny. It's a very egalitarian society out there, and I have I'm no prejudice. I don't have a lot of class prejudice. I was raised in fairly humble surroundings, but my people were very proud. Mm. And my father was a noble character, so I never felt inferior to anybody because I didn't have the clothing they had. I didn't have the possessions they had. Never felt it, ever. So I have no prejudice against rich people, which is good because I'm president of a nonprofit.
It helps in talking to them if you like people across the board.
You would be amazed. There's a kind of mutual shyness that goes on because if you had a lot of money, you'd suddenly be aware that there are an awful lot of people sort of circulating in your way wanting to exploit you.
Right.
And so it's very isolating to have money. You end up hanging around with other rich people, and that can be a little dreary.
Yeah.
And it's same with celebrities. That same syndrome will set in.
Right.
And it's not because they think. I mean, there are jerks who just have big egos, but I don't think they're any more numerous among the celebrated or money classes than they are among people of more humble walks.
Exactly.
So it's nice at Burning Man you can come and be a real celebrity, be a TV celebrity or movie celebrity and just disappear and be yourself and no one will persecute you. That makes it very plausible to take Burning Man back into the world in the end. Because its roots go. A consistent mistake people have made is to say that we're a counterculture.
Right.
Now, countercultures didn't start until about mid-20th century. They replaced avant-gardes. And they were different from avant-gardes. Avant-gardes aspired to change the world. That had started in Europe and has a long lineage of its own. Countercultures walked away from the world and said, we're against the world. We're against the squares. We're against but they didn't aspire to change that world. They just aspired to feel superior to it in their sense of self-election. Now, that's not a kind criticism, but I think it has accurate aspects. And the counter and counterculture means you're against the establishment.
Well, I mean, that's a little.
But it doesn't mean that you have anything to replace it. It just means that you. And if you look at the history of countercultures in the U.S., the sense of detachment, of lack of relation to the greater culture grows more and more profound as you move from the beatniks, who were half avant-gardists, then you move to the hippies. And finally, the punks and the estrangement, the sense of alienation. And what the countercultures were expressing were resistance to the engulfing the influence of postmodern capitalism and the commodification of everything in the world.
Right, and in some ways a reaction to even the existence of the atomic bomb and
sure.
You know, a kind of nihilism.
You know, they asked Marlon Brando in the motorcycle movie, what are you what are you rebelling against? And he said, what do you got?
What do you got?
And that reactive pose, you know, sustained in a mild faux form by hundreds of alt weeklies across the country, is an attitude, but it isn't leads very
and
far.
And yet punk rock in some ways gives birth to Burning Man, because you also have to do it yourself attitude in there. The idea that you can grasp, grab the tools and make something
roots,
for yourself.
A good part, not all, but a good part of our roots are in the counterculture, in the underground society of San Francisco and all of that. But it seems to me that it's time to reverse that tendency and go back into the world with the confidence that you needn't be corrupted by it. And indeed, if you look at the demise of most countercultures, it's because people didn't hang together. They hung separately and they sold out separately too. Mm-hmm. Look at the hippies; they sold out at a mighty good clip, and they had no critique of capitalism. They had no critique of society. They really didn't have a coherent, meditative view of it. I think that any group that can do that can re-enter society and maintain its integrity intact.
All right, we're going to have to leave it at that. And thanks a lot for coming in twice on the same day.
Well, it's the back and forth has been wearing, but I don't mind. Right.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Bye bye.
We'd like to thank Larry Harvey for joining us once again today. The music you heard today was Sakura Michi by Junko Yanagida. Next week, Charlie Anders and Annalee Newitz from Other, the magazine of politics and pop culture for the new outcasts. The Are You Serious show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Check out all the shows at mondoglobo.net. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.